From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You've read many stories about many different magazine heroes, but there's never been a story like this one, because there's never been a hero like Spider-Man.
No, there's never been a superhero like Spider-Man, or Superman, or Wonder Woman, or Batman, though technically he's not a superhero. And let's not forget the Flash, the Green Lantern, or He-Man, or Inspector Gadget, the Wonder Twins, Wolverine, Ghost Rider, the Fantastic Four, Underdog. How about the Teenage Ninja Mutant Turtles, the Bionic Woman, Tank Girl, Mighty Mouse, Swamp Thing, Astro Boy, the Powerpuff Girls, Dr. Manhattan? Remember Wonder Warthog? How about the Flaming Carrot? Or Captain Caveman? Not to mention Captain America. And even Captain Underpants. Iron Man, Aquaman, Miracle Man, The Incredibles, The Incredible Hulk. This hour, unto the best of our knowledge, superheroes. But first, sure, superheroes can save the day by defeating villains, but can they stand up to the laws of physics? James Kakalios is a physicist and author of The Physics of Superheroes. When I got a chance to visit with Kakalios, I asked him the most obvious question. Can Superman leap tall buildings in a single bound?
Physics would say that it's actually not that impossible. At least the way Superman was first presented when he first appeared in June 1938. His powers then were ascribed to the fact that his home planet Krypton had a larger gravity than that of Earth. So just as our muscles and skeleton structure are adapted to Earth's gravity, when we go to the moon, which has a gravity only 1/6 as large, we can leap moon buildings in a single bound and, you know, lift moon cars over our head, which astonish the moon people. Superman, presumably coming from a planet with a larger gravity, is similarly stronger on Earth with our weaker gravity. And that was the explanation that was originally presented in the comic books.
I don't want to talk about Superman forever, of course, but mm-hmm. once you start, you sort of have to continue through a couple of these things anyway, because they're interesting. The X-ray vision, the heat mm-hmm. vision, the invulnerable skin. And I guess it wasn't invulnerable in the beginning, was it?
Yes. In the very first appearances, it was listed as nothing less than a bursting shell could penetrate his skin. So again, it was the notion that he was a lot stronger and tougher because he came from a denser and heavier planet, but he wasn't invulnerable. He could lift a car over his head, but not, say, a continent. And if you look at the strength levels he exhibited early on, asking how much force would it take to leap a tall building in a single bound, the force needed to lift a car overhead, and then work backwards and ask, what does this imply about the gravity of Krypton? The minimum excess gravity Krypton must have had is about 15 times greater than Earth. And that doesn't sound like that much, but it turns out to be surprisingly difficult to build a planet with that much gravity, consistent with what we know about science and the material properties of matter. You can build it, but it's hard to keep it from exploding, which it turns out is exactly what Krypton did. So obviously, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, these two teenagers from Cleveland, Ohio, who created Superman, obviously had an understanding of relativistic astrophysics far advanced than most scientists at the time.
Well, part of what's fascinating is that it sounds as though when they were creating it, they actually did try to take science into account, minimally, and not with the intensity that a physics professor would demand. But at least they were trying to think scientifically. After that, well, it was a
Absolutely.
Success of the imagination.
Absolutely. Jerry Siegel, the writer of the early Superman stories and co-creator with Joe Shuster, was a real fan of science fiction pulp magazines. And at the time, those pulp magazines frequently featured stories of what we would call hard science fiction. Science fiction that it asked for one impossible leap of faith, and then everything else that happened in the story tried to be as accurate as possible and consistent with known science as possible. And so that was the philosophy. Even after Jerry Siegel's no longer doing this, in the 60s, you see a lot of comic book writers, especially at DC Comics, that are doing this. They say, well, if you could run at super speed, let's just grant that you could, but then you could do things like run across the ocean or up the side of a building or drag people behind you in your wake and catch bullets in midair. All things that the character who can run at super speed is shown doing, all things that are consistent with physics once you make that grant that one miracle exemption from the laws of nature that enables the superpowers in the first place.
It's sort of fun to grant that and then yes. go on from there. And the Flash really was the one who was always able to run up the side of sides of buildings, as I remember.
Right, right. The Flash was a superhero who he was actually a scientist, a police scientist, who was alone in a storeroom when he was struck by lightning and doused with chemicals. And rather than suffering permanent neurological damage, he gained the ability to run at super speed. But he would frequently use his scientific knowledge when he had to solve whatever problem he faced in his monthly comics. If he, for some arcane reason, he couldn't directly touch someone, he could knock them out by dragging objects behind him in his wake and then ducking down, and they would continue on with their inertia and hit the person and knock him out. Or sometimes run so fast that he creates a sonic boom, a shock front, and uses that to knock the person out. So he would use physics with his powers in order to solve his problems of the month.
And actually, he'd have been a happy guest on Oprah, wouldn't he, because of what you call the Central City Diet.
Well, he certainly would. That's right, because you could ask, how much would you have to eat to run at super speed? And it turns out to be an unphysically large amount, 500 million cheeseburgers, just every time you needed to run at even a fraction of the speed of light, which was nowhere near his top speed. So, yeah, so even chewing at super speed, it would be pretty much a full-time job.
Yeah. Now, you actually have some personal experience with this, don't you? You were the physics advisor to the Watchmen film. Why did the Watchmen want to get the science right?
Watchmen, the film, was based on the DC Comics miniseries, a graphic novel that came out in the mid-1980s. And among comic book fans, Watchmen is considered, say, the Citizen Kane of comic books. And so in this adaptation, directed by Zack Snyder, they were trying to be as accurate and faithful to the original graphic novel as possible. So at one point I thought, well, what do they need me for? Because if I'm going to tell them that something is not physically correct, but it was in the graphic novel, and they had a choice between upsetting a million Watchmen fans or one physics professor from Minnesota, well, I know what choice I'd make, and I'm the physics professor from Minnesota. So, but what they wanted to know is, like, not only things, technical points, like how did a physics lab look like in 1985? What would it look like in 1959? We see Dr. Manhattan working on some equipment here. What do you think he might be doing? But they wanted to actually know how his powers might possibly work. This is a character who has quantum mechanical powers. And they wanted to know how this could function, because the production designer, Alex McDowell, said, we want to know what's around the corner of a long hallway, even if the audience doesn't go down that corridor. They need to make things as accurate as possible, because any moment that the audience is watching this and thinking, that's not right from a science point of view, or that's not what a lab looks like, is a moment that they're not paying attention to the story. And so it's in their best interest to tell a compelling story with a believable and realistic fake reality that they try to get the science as right as possible.
But still pretty fun, even when the science is wrong, right?
Absolutely. I agree completely. And when I read these comics and when I go to the movies to see the latest superhero movie, I don't go with a pad of paper and a pen and a calculator, you know, Professor Grump, and say, ooh, my physics sense is tingling. But rather, it's more the case of when you see that they get it right, it's like catching an inside joke.
Well, it's a little like the way the artist should study anatomy before drawing the people. You want the study the physics before drawing the ramp.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Or at least put a little bit of an acknowledgement in there, or a little tip of the hat every now and then. There's this one comic that came out in the 80s featuring a DC comic superhero, the Atom, who has the ability to shrink down to subatomic size. And I mean really subatomic. In one story, He and a friend are having a very private conversation as they sit on an electron. And at one point, the friend stops, turns to the atom, and says, "We're smaller than oxygen molecules. How are we breathing?" And the atom gives the only answer that he can. He says, "I'm not sure." And then they just move on with the story and just continue on. But it was at least a recognition from the writer to the reader that, yeah, it's a comic book. Relax.
James Kakalios teaches physics at the University of Minnesota, and he's the author of The Physics of Superheroes.
Here I come to save the day. That means that Mighty Mouse is on the way. Yes!
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Silently, the monstrous being that was once Bruce Banner crouches in the shadows.
Hulk! Hulk!
Hong Kong Fooey, number one super guy. Hong Kong Fooey, quicker than the human eye.
There's no need to fear, Underdog is here.
A web, any size, catches thieves, just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.
Sounds like a job for Superman. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Happy birthday, Wonder Woman. Yes, Wonder Woman is 70, on par with Superman and the Green Lantern as one of the oldest comic book superheroes. Superheroines. Wonder Woman fights injustice with her lasso of truth, invisible jet, and bullet-deflecting armbands. So, how did Wonder Woman celebrate her 70th birthday? Well, with a costume change. A major costume change. Now, if your first reaction is, holy, messing with a cultural icon, Batman, you're not alone. Not at all. Steve Paulson sat down with Jim Lee, the co-publisher of DC Comics, and the man who drew the new Wonder Woman, to talk about the controversy.
I want to start with a blog posting from a woman, a self-described Wonder Woman fan in her mid-60s, who said, "You wouldn't mess with McDonald's Golden Arches or Nike's Swoosh, so why are they replacing Wonder Woman's star-spangled panties with this? This is not my Wonder Woman."
Well, I would say in counter to that, the Swoosh and the Arches aren't, you know, fictional, living, breathing characters. You know, Wonder Woman's been around for decades, and I think a character, a female character, having the same look for 70 years is kind of pushing it. I mean, you know, it's incumbent upon us as creators and also as a co-publisher to really keep these characters fresh. And the only way you can make them fresh and keep them fresh is by introducing change. Anytime you get to a point where they are as is, you know, that they all have to be drawn a certain way, that they all have essentially a costume that is not fungible or changeable, I think you're just inviting ossification to come in. You're just inviting people to get bored with the characters. And what's been interesting about this whole process with changing the golden arches, you know, as an analogy, is that how many people and how broad of a reaction we got. It was actually probably more intense than we anticipated. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was partly great timing and not a lot going on news-wise that day. But, you know, this is a character that touches so many different people. And, you know, for a lot of people, like the person that wrote that blog, you know, these are sort of real characters, even though they're fictional.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe Wonder Woman's new costume?
Yeah. Basically, she has dark blue black tights on instead of the swim trunk. And she has a red bustier kind of body armor on top. And then she's got a black flak jacket that she pulled out from some vintage store from the 80s. I got a lot of heat for that one. And then she has a smaller tiara on her head, you know. And one of the big changes was to the gauntlets, the bracelets on her arm, on her forearms. They actually now have a W inscribed upon them so that when she hits a villain, they get a nice tattoo, sort of an impression of a W. She kind of leaves her calling card on their faces. So in a way, she looks a little more street. She looks a little more like someone that could blend into a crowd as opposed to someone that sort of leaps out and jumps out and says, hey, I'm a superhero. If Wonder Woman were created today, what would she look like? If Wonder Woman were created today and she were fighting crime, would you go out there with, you know, trunks with blue stars all over your, you know,
Well,
your
it was
bottom,
kind of like, you know, the old costume was verging pretty close to a bikini.
Yeah. Well, no, you know
it's kind of hard to battle villains in that, or
sure.
One would think.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it's great for trick or treating, but, you know, not so great for fighting crime.
Now, for lack of a better word, the new Wonder Woman costume is less sexist, I think you could say, less revealing, less overtly sexual, as you say, more modern, more street tough. And you would think that feminists would love this. And yet I read somewhere that Gloria Steinem told the AP that the new costume gives us the idea that only pants can be powerful. Tell that to Greek warriors and sumo wrestlers.
Right.
You can't win, can you?
I think, exactly. I think she was mad because there was a bunch of guys that redefined Wonder Woman, even though Wonder Woman was created by a man. This wasn't a feminist change. It wasn't a change to appease feminists. It wasn't an issue of sexuality. It was more of, does a costume fit the storyline that we have? If we were to create Wonder Woman today, what would she look like? How does a costume like that compare to Batman's costume or Superman's costume? If you line them up, does that costume look appropriate in today's sort of pantheon of superheroes?
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a political dimension to this, too, because she used to wear the American flag, and she doesn't anymore. And Fox News, in fact, actually did a poll questioning.
Wow, you did a lot of research.
Yeah, we dig here. What can I say? They questioned the patriotism of DC Comics. So why ditch the American flag?
Honestly, that was mildly insulting. You know, first off, I mean, we're super patriotic. I'm a naturalized citizen. That never factored in at all. I mean, I think if you look at the costume, it wasn't about eliminating or marginalizing the elements that are American. You know, I put that in quotation marks. First of all, she's a character from Amazon Island, so she's not an American citizen. Second of all, what we did with the costume was really bring down all the bold, iconic elements that sort of screamed out, I'm a superhero, I'm a brand, I'm a, you know, a symbol. So we took the tiara and made it a smaller kind of element on her forehead. We reduced the amount of bright contrasting colors. It's a more somber, more muted costume. It has nothing to do with a political change in outlook on the character or as a company or any of that kind of stuff. It was a completely creative decision.
Now, look, what are Wonder Woman's superpowers? She can fly, she has incredible strength, super agility, she's got the lasso of truth, the bulletproof bracelets. Am I missing anything here?
Yeah, she's got the invisible plane. I don't know if that's really a power, but it's a pretty cool thing. You know, it's one of those quirky things. I mean, think about a lot of these characters that were created decades ago. They all have a little bit of a quirky quality to them. And for a character that can fly to have a invisible jet, kind of seems redundant. But to me, one of the things that she was kind of lacking for so long is all her powers, or her, you know, from the bracelets to the lasso, they're all kind of defensive. They're all very sort of passive kind of powerful items. You know, lasso of truth is super powerful in its usefulness, but, you know, hard to defeat criminals that are charging at you with a lasso. And the same thing with, you know, bulletproof bracelets. You have to be shot at to deflect it. It's like, what is her offensive power? How does she, you know, how does she take it to the villains? Well, she can fly up and punch him. It's just another way of visualizing her abilities and strengths as a warrior. And I think that's a lot of times fans kind of forget that she's a superhero, but she's actually technically an Amazonian warrior, as long as a diplomat and ambassador. And as a warrior, she should have the accoutrements of a warrior, from the shield to a magical sword. And the fact that there's this whole pantheon of gods that and goddesses that have granted her powers, you know, for her to have, like, for instance, like the spear of Athena would be awesome. And I think these are the kinds of things that should be interwoven within this character.
Hmm. You must have thought about what it means to have a superpower who's a woman. You know, maybe the most famous female superhero
absolutely
as a woman.
Absolutely the most famous. Absolutely. There's no one else close to it. I mean, there's not even a close second. I was talking to someone on the phone on the way in to this interview.
Uh-huh.
You know, name me another female character that is as well-known and as iconic as Wonder Woman. There is a huge drop-off from Wonder Woman to the next level. I mean, whereas you have Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, you know, there's a whole cluster of male heroes. But on the female side is Wonder Woman, and then you have this gigantic leap down to, I don't even know.
Were the stakes higher because of that? Because you were changing her story, changing her costume? I mean, this is the most visible female superhero out there.
Sure. I knew I was walking into a hail of bullets when I took on this assignment. The fan side of me went, like, the red flag went up, like, I hate it, I hate it, I hate any change. And, like, how dare you? You're destroying my memories, my childhood. And because that's the way I was as a fan, too. I hated change. You know, I was a huge X-Men fan as a kid, and Wolverine, you know, had this iconic yellow and blue costume. And then John Byrne came in, and he gave him this kind of orange-brown costume. I was like, this is horrible. This is gross. But then within like 3 months, I loved it. So I think people, you know, fans are just very resistant to change. These are their fictional friends. And as friends, they're very protective of them and of their memories of those characters. And so, you know, not all change sticks. But if you don't introduce the idea of change, you don't get a lot of the cool stuff that's in comics today.
Jim Lee is co-publisher of DC Comics and the man who drew the new Wonder Woman costume. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Images of Wonder Woman, before and after, are, of course, available on our website at ttbook.org. And while you're there, send us an email. We want to know what you think of the new Wonder Woman.
In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe, Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission: to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
This hour we're talking about superheroes, Wonder Woman, Superman, and Spider-Man. But that's comic book stuff. What about the real world? What if you actually had real superpowers? Athlete, fashion model, and activist Amy Mullins has superpowers. A dozen of them, to be exact. They are her prosthetic legs. And the powers they grant her? Amazing speed, beauty, and an extra 6 inches of height are also redefining what it means to be abled in our society. Amy Mullins spoke with Anne Strainchamps about her superpowers.
The idea of having superpowers refers to a particular bit of enlightenment I experienced amongst a group of, you know, 6-year-olds that I had challenged to come up with anything they could imagine, whether it was a cartoon character, a superhero, you know, an animal, anything they could think of that if I wanted to be able to jump over a 3-story house, what kind of legs would you want to build me? And they were instantaneous in their responses of kangaroos and frogs and Google Gadget and, you know, all sorts of Japanese anime characters that I wasn't even familiar with yet. And immediately a boy said, but wait a second, why wouldn't you want to fly too? And everybody got so excited, including me. And, you know, for me, the poignancy of that experience was the immediate and palpable shift in the way that these children would have been trained to see me, a woman who has to wear prosthetic legs every day, as disabled. That word has a lot of weight to it. And in that instant, I became somebody who was super able, somebody who had potential in her body that most people don't have. You know, I mean, and we're talking, obviously, theoretically, with jumping over houses and flying, but, you know, we're coming closer and closer to things that 30 years ago were sci-fi TV programs.
We should talk about your running legs, the famous cheetah legs. Can you describe those and tell me something about what it's like to wear them?
Most prosthetics historically always were meant to replicate the loss of a limb, right? So you model the prosthetic off of the flesh and bone leg. Well, if I was trying to be the fastest woman in the world on artificial legs and I didn't have to have human legs, it was like, why are we looking at them? Why aren't we looking at the fastest thing that runs? The idea of having this super energy efficient design in woven carbon fiber that mimicked the way the hind leg of a cheetah worked, and also the way sprinters, you know, sprinters run on the balls of their feet. So when I would switch, I would warm up and train in the shock absorber legs, and then I would switch to the cheetah legs actually to do sprinting or sprinting drills, because it's like if you were to stand up right now and stand on the balls of your feet, you'd realize you have very little balance. You know, you have to be moving. You know, so hamstrings go into contraction, gluteals, hip flexors, and it was the closest thing we could, as amputees, could experience to the way a sprinter really runs. And also, you know, I mean, I grew up on wooden legs, like a wood plastic compound. So 100% of the energy that I used to take a step was dissipated into the ground. Whereas the human leg, because it's a series of motors and springs, actually gives you almost a 240% return. I mean, it's an incredible thing to think about, that you actually get more energy back from the use of your leg. And this woven carbon foot gives you somewhere around 87% energy return. So you're still losing, you know, at least 10, 15% energy with every step, but it's so much better than what everyone had before.
I've seen you on stage in, I suppose, the legs that give you the greatest height, and you were wearing really stacked high heels also, and I think you said you were 6'1". You make a very beautiful, very imposing presence. Do you find that people respond to you differently depending on which legs you're wearing?
Yes, I do find that they respond differently. You know, it's interesting because even just people that I've known for many, many years who knew me, you know, at a certain height, who knew me at sort of 5'8", 5'9"-ish, and then to suddenly be 6'1", I find that sometimes it's apparent, it's disconcerting for people. Or they've actually been verbal with it, with telling me, gosh, it's just, this is freaking me out. You're so tall.
Well, you tell this great story about meeting a girlfriend once when you first got your really tall legs, and her response was to feel jealous.
Yes, she is stuck at 5'3" or something, you know, and she puts on, of course, she wears some major stacked heels herself, but, you know, she just said to me outright, but you're so tall. I said, I know, isn't it? And it was literally the first night I'd been wearing these. I was out on the town, so it was completely an exploration for me. I was like, wow, I really found that I had to move with momentum, because to slow down in the heels was like, whoa, I'm not used to this yet. And I was just laughing about how much fun this was and how much of an adventure this was and how weird it was to suddenly see the molding of the tops of doors in a different way. And she said, but Amy, but it's not fair. And, you know, to my surprise, she was serious. She was admitting an envy of that trait. And I have to say, I think it is an enviable trait. I think a lot of people would find the fun in being able to change your height at will.
Still, doesn't it strike you sometimes how very far we've come in this conversation?
I think the shift is nothing short of profound. And it's really been in the last 3 years. For many, many years, Anne, I had to sit through interview after interview and politely grin when somebody keeps referring to me as disabled. It's like, how can you with a straight face look at Brian McKeever, you know, the Canadian skier who is visually impaired and, you know, set the Canadian national record in his sport? How can you sit with a straight face, say that that person is disabled because of their visual impairment? They're doing something on the same level as other elite athletes in the world. You know, that's quite frankly super ability to me.
You know, we've been talking about reconfiguring how we think of ability. You've also kind of pushed the edge in terms of how we think of what we think about beauty and what it means to be a gorgeous woman. You've also, besides running, you've also wound up working in the fashion world a certain amount of time. You know, you've shared the runway with supermodels like Kate Moss and Naomi Campbell. Your name has shown up on magazine lists of the 10 hottest women in the world. This is also important to you?
You know, it wasn't important to me, but when it happened, I have to say that there was a sense of a real coup for me. You know, I mean, I found it very interesting. There was a photograph by a photographer named Howard Schatz, and it's a black and white photograph, and it was part of a coffee table book he did called Athlete. And he had all the men wear black kind of boxer briefs and the women wearing black kind of Speedo briefs with a black sports bra, with the idea being that black, you know, it neutralizes any bumps that you would see. In other words, he was intentionally trying to take any kind of overt sexuality out of these photographs. He wanted it to be about the beauty of the human body doing these incredible athletic feats. And so it's a photo of me taken in the studio coming out of the starting blocks. And what was interesting was that Sports Illustrated did a feature on me, and they put this photo on their website, and it caused somewhat of a, you know, stir amongst certain feminist bloggers, you know, which was interesting to me because at the time I was the president of the Women's Sports Foundation and, you know, have always considered myself a feminist. And the stir was about this photo being too sexy. And that I wasn't being heralded for my athletic achievement or my intellect, but, you know, for basically having a great butt, which, by the way, I did work very, very hard for. It was like, yes, actually, I kind of appreciate my body being captured on film at the time when I was training this many hours a week. And I found it very interesting because I thought, wow, so I've actually moved up to the level where I can be objectified like any other woman now. How interesting that I've come from the, you know, primordial ooze where it was untouchable to be sexy, right, as a woman missing her limbs mid shin down, and now it's you know, too sexy. I thought, well, that's I'll take that.
I don't know if you ever read when you were a girl a book called Ozma of Oz. It's one of the sequels to The Wizard of Oz, and there's this character in it. She's a princess, and instead of changing her gown every day, she changes heads. And she has this really gorgeous dressing room like every little girl dreams about, with a collection of beautiful heads. You know,
that is fabulous. I've never even heard of this.
Oh, there's a redhead with green eyes and a temper, and there's a sultry brunette, and there's a perky blonde. And
oh, wait, so the different heads provide different temperaments?
Yes, they have different temperaments too, so she can choose not only which head she wants to wear in which situation, but which persona she wants as a little girl.
Well, there is like that. My legs have that power for me.
Really?
For sure. Absolutely. It's funny, I got approached by a grad school project that was presenting something to Mattel, and it was about how, you know, they were shocked that 20% of the United States technically has a disability. But yet, you know, Mattel has ever done two dolls, and they've been, you know, it's kind of like Share a Smile Barbie or something that feels a bit patronizing. And I think the Barbie who used a wheelchair, I think, was only, you know, produced for a couple years. And, you know, so they wanted to do a Barbie that had changeable prosthetic legs. And I kind of loved that idea of it, that, you know, you could just picture the little playing card size box of carved Barbie's wooden legs, right, or Barbie's, right, Karl Lagerfeld glass legs. And, you know, I think that today's generation of kids are extraordinary receptacles to these kinds of ideas, because they've grown up with Second Life and Avatar and choosing their own identities with how they bond through social media. And this idea of creating and recreating yourself and having these different facets of yourself is really tangible to this generation of kids.
Yeah, but the thing that's so exciting about talking with you is we may be used to that happening in virtual space, but with you it's happening in real flesh and blood.
Yeah, amen. Hey, woman.
Amy Mullins speaking with Anne Strangechamps. To see photos of Amy Mullins and her 12 pairs of superpower prosthetic legs, go to our website at ttbook.org.
Thunder, 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 Thundercats, ho!
Thundercats are on me. Thundercats are loose.
I am Captain Planet.
Nobody's gonna chain the ever-loving thing. It's Clobber and Tar.
By the power of Grayskull,
universe.
Trouble, Space Ghost?
It could be. I've got to try blocking it off as Hawkman.
Calling Powdered Toast Man. Please respond. Come in, Powdered Toast Man.
Powdered Toast Man!
Danger Mouse! Amazing Danger Mouse! Astounding Danger Mouse!
How about you? Do you have a favorite superhero? For me, it was Iron Man. Pre-movie Iron Man. I have a whole box full of comics. Anyway, you can tell us about yours via email at ttbook.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, where we have a special superheroes discussion page waiting for you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Over the past year, the United States has been reaching out and listening. We've joined interfaith dialogues and held town halls, roundtables, and listening sessions with thousands of people around the world, including many of you. And like so many people, you've extended your hand in return, each in your own way, as entrepreneurs and educators, as leaders of faith and of science. I have to say, perhaps the most innovative response was from Dr. Naif Al-Mutawa of Kuwait, who joins us here tonight. Where is Dr. Mutawa? Right here. His comic books have captured the imagination of so many young people with superheroes who embody the teachings and tolerance of Islam. After my speech in Cairo, he had a similar idea. So in his comic books, Superman and Batman reached out to their Muslim counterparts. And I hear they're making progress, too. Absolutely.
That's President Barack Obama speaking about The 99. The 99 is a comic book series based on Islamic culture and religion, where the 99 superheroes each derive a superpower from the 99 attributes of Allah. Created by Naif Al-Mutawa, the comic book is sweeping the Arab world. Steve Paulson asked Naif Al-Mutawa to explain the backstory of the 99.
The backstory of the 99 takes place during the fall of Baghdad in 1258. And the reason for that, I think, I'm just psychoanalyzing myself, is because when I came up with the concept, Baghdad had just fallen in 2003. And it just linked back in my mind to a story that we had heard generation after generation in my part of the world. It's about the sacking of Baghdad in 1258. And there's a famous library back then called Dar al-Hikmah, and all the books in that library were dumped in the Tigris River, and the Tigris changes color with ink because there are so many books in there. It's a story that every kid in my region knows. And what I did is I rewrote that story with an alternate reality, which is basically that the Mongols came in to destroy the library. That was what they were coming for. But the librarians found out this was going to happen, and they hatched a plan to save that information onto 99 stones.
Now, is there particular symbolism within Muslim tradition about these sacred stones that you have created as sort of the cornerstone of your comic book series?
Well, I made up that story in the stones there, but there's a story, for example, from the Quran. During the year of the elephant, as it's known, which is the year the Prophet, peace be upon him, was born, Abraha, the king of Ethiopia, marched on Mecca, on the Kaaba, to destroy it. And according to the Quran, God stopped him in his tracks by sending birds, and those birds had stones, and they kind of, you know, chucked the stones at the elephants. The elephants were, you know, were killed in their tracks, and that's how the Kaaba was saved. So if you think about the storylines of the 99, the main bad guy, his name is Rugal. And in fact, the guy that gave directions to Abraha's army back in the year of the elephant, his name was Abu Rugal, father of Rugal. And so here's Rugal trying to destroy how I see kind of the future of, you know, Islam in terms of being tolerant and peaceful, etc. Even though the religion's not in the storylines, but that's kind of what he represents. And the 99, you know, are superheroes, and superheroes, you know, typically fly. Not all of mine do, but, you know, so they're kind of like birds, right? And they stop him using their stones. They don't pelt him with the stones, but that's kind of the archetype that I lifted from the Quran.
So each of these stones has a particular attribute, or in superpower language, a particular power.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell me about some of these.
Sure. They're based on the 99 attributes of Allah in the Quran, so things like generosity and wisdom and foresight. But there's also things like, you know, destruction and power. And, you know, there's a yin and a yang in the attributes of Allah. And actually, one of the things I was dealing with when I was first creating the characters was, you know, am I going to have all the boys being hegemonous, strong, the destroyer, and the girls being kind and merciful? And I was like, you know what? I want something in here for everyone. And so Mumita, our destroyer kind of martial artist character, is a girl. And Jabbar, one of the muscles, is a boy. And so it kind of evened out the teams. And there's, you know, there would be exactly half boys, half girls. But the thing is, 99 is an odd number, so it's tough to do that.
Hmm. Now, do your superheroes differ from the kind of superheroes that many of us would know from Western traditions, like Superman and Batman?
Yes and no. The Western tradition superheroes are based on Judeo-Christian archetypes. So, for example, like the prophets, all the superheroes are orphaned or missing parents. Superman's parents die in Krypton. Batman's parents die when he's sick. Spider-Man's, we don't even know. He's raised by his aunt and uncle. And all of them get their message from above through a messenger. The prophets get it from God through Gabriel, but Peter Parker's taking a photograph in Manhattan when the spider descends from above and gives him his message through a bite, right? Superman is not only sent from the heavens or from Krypton, but he sent in a pod, very much like Moses was on the Nile. And then you hear the voice of his father, Jor-El, saying to Earth, I have sent to you my only son. Right? I mean, that's kind of God in the Bible. And those, in a very kind of Judeo-Christian Greek tradition, those heroes all have an Achilles heel. Right? So you have Superman can do like everything, but Kryptonite gets him. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, yes, they do differ. My characters are based on teamwork, and they're diverse, and you know, it's not the red, white, and blue of Superman and Spider-Man, etc. At the same time, my characters do include superheroes from North America and South America and the Middle East and Europe, and it kind of democratizes the superhero concept because it's not who you are or where you're from or what your power is that makes you the hero. It's more the context of the situation, because in a lot of situations, our big guy, Jabbar, the guy with the muscles, gets pushed aside because love or mercy can solve that same situation.
And what's striking about your series is your heroes are most powerful when they work together.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is, I suppose, not always the case with Superman. He's a guy who can do it alone.
He can, but he's going to need the 99 in the upcoming crossover.
Oh, you have to talk about that. Pretty exciting. Your 99 superheroes are going to team up with Superman and Batman and other characters from the Justice League, right?
Yeah, very exciting. Very, very excited. The first book comes out in October 2010, and it's President Obama called it the most innovative response to his Cairo speech, because what I did, you know, he reached out to the Muslim world, and in response, my characters reached right back out to their American counterparts. And basically, you know, it's a storyline that starts off with distrust, because the bad guys cause the distrust, and then it moves over to trust. And, you know, the characters will be standing cape to shoulder and facing things that challenge all humanity.
So was this comic book series your response to what happened on 9/11 or to the war in Iraq?
It was a more response to 9/11 than the war in Iraq. When 9/11 happened, I was a practicing psychologist. I was training at Bellevue in the Survivors of Political Torture program. I had just left a couple months before then. And in the therapy sessions, one of the things that struck me is that again and again, the story of a young man who grew up idolizing their leadership only to end up being tortured by them. And torture is a terrible enough thing as it is, but when your hero's torturing you, what's that? I mean, it just destroys you on many, many levels. And, I quit doing that, went to business school at Columbia University, got accepted right before 9/11 and started around then. And during that time, I was thinking, what am I going to do with my life now? I have a doctorate in psychology and I have now an MBA from Columbia. And I couldn't see myself going to business for business's sake. And one of the things that really troubled me as a psychologist, when somebody comes to see you as a patient or a client, how do you work? It's mostly to do with perception. How does a person see themselves? How do they think others see them? And somewhere in the middle there, you do your work. Well, I wasn't happy with how Islam was being seen in the West, but I was more unhappy with how Islam was seeing itself. That, for me, was the more important thing. Because if you fix yourself, then you can kind of fix the other stuff. And for me, I felt 9/11, Islam became the average of 9/11 and what it was before 9/11, which basically, it's a regression to a mean, and that mean is very mean because it moves more towards 9/11. That's what benefits, right? And so the thinking was, in the West, when things go that nuts, what do you guys say? You say, sounds like a job for Superman. But there was no Superman. And so I felt that by creating something that could kind of fly in the face of what happened in 9/11 and kind of go in the other direction, where I can go back to the same place that these guys pulled out their hateful messages and pull out peaceful, loving messages, then they just become bad guys with bad messages. Because if the same source can be linked to good and bad, then it's not the source, it's the interpreter of the source. And that's how I chose to kind of go after it. So that's how it was more of a reaction to kind of the bad things happening in the name of my religion.
Now, you've said that you were, to some degree, drawing on Muslim tradition in creating this. I mean, for instance, the 99 attributes of Allah. Do you have to be theologically careful about how you construct your storyline?
When I first started, I kept being asked, did you talk to any scholars or any theologians? And I'd always avoid that question like the plague. And the reason I'd avoid it is I didn't want to ask this guy and have him, kind of endorse what I'm doing. And then that guy who he had a fight with 30 years ago on a playground kind of unendorsed me because they still don't talk to each other. And so I'd avoid that. And then if I get pushed, I'd say, well, I spoke to Emo Phillips. They'd say, Sheikh Phillips, we haven't heard of him. I said, that's a good thing because he's a comedian. Like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, Emo Phillips used to say that every day to the age of 10, he used to pray to God for a bicycle. And then by 10, he realized that God didn't work that way. So he stole the bicycle and started praying for forgiveness. I have 99 working in teams of three. Why three? Because within Islam, you have this idea that you don't leave boys and girls alone together. Now, I'm not proselytizing. There's no religious messages in the storylines. But, to get them into these storylines, into the crevices where it's needed, you got to kind of understand the rules and play by them, but make it in a way that's mature and kind of can work for all audiences. So I have teams of three, two boys and a girl, two girls and a boy, three boys, three girls, no problem. Well, and also Carl Jung also spoke about the importance of the number three in all cultures through his work on archetypes. And so I figured, between Carl Jung and between this, I this is the right formula. I got accused by somebody who's more hardline Islamic thinker that the Pope sent me to the Middle East to preach the Trinity through the use of the number three and the nine. So, you believe who you want. I give you my version of the story, But see, these things are like, it's like you run in circles with these things. One of the examples that I love, it happened actually here in the U.S. back when evolution was no longer it was a when, and the top universities all accepted it. Some group in the Bible Belt said, pretty much, that's right, those fossils are real. They prove evolution, but the devil put them there. So, you get into these kind of circular logics, things go around in circles that it's, for me, I felt, I'm not happy on that treadmill anymore. I'm not happy like that hamster. I need to kind of move the conversation forward and not be involved in these debates and get dragged down by somebody who has a little bit of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Now, getting back to your series, The 99, your chief villain is this guy, Rugal.
Yeah.
What would you say is his, what makes him a villain?
Rugal basically is a fascist. Rugal was around in 1492 when basically, Grenada fell and that's where the 99 stones were headquartered. And he wanted to use those stones to fight off Isabel and Ferdinand's army that were coming to take Grenada. And so the metaphor there is he wanted to use religion for war, basically. But the people who were keeping their eye on the stones to make sure they were safe didn't agree with that these stones were not meant for war. And he went and tried to take all the powers of all the stones into himself and basically tried to become a god. And he couldn't. He disintegrated and reintegrated back, you know, 500 years later. But this idea that, you know, one of the irony is that the biggest sin you can commit as a Muslim is something called shirk, which comes from the word sharik, which means partner. So if you claim that you're God's partner, then that's the biggest sin. And the irony is that these guys out there is, you know, calling, saying this is against Islam, that's against Islam. That's what they're doing. You know, they're making themselves God's partner and doing it in the name of God, which is just, you know, if they didn't do so much evil, you know, it'd be funny. But, and the other thing, Rugal is very paranoid because the stones have a mechanism to self-update. He wants to stop that. Because if he can limit the knowledge in the stones, then he can control the stones and their bearers. But Ramsey doesn't have that anxiety. So the stones are able to self-update and kind of, you know, modernize themselves to the 21st century, whereas Rugal wants them stuck in the 15th century because it's what he understands.
You know, I could imagine that this message wouldn't go over very well in certain countries that have that, that tradition.
What message?
Of tyranny.
Huh? What are you talking about? You trying to get me in trouble? See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, no.
Naif al-Murtawa is the creator of the 99. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Naif al-Murtawa lives in his native Kuwait with his wife and five sons. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Superheroes, program number 95A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Ann Strain Champs, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Brittany DeAnda. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
I always wondered why nobody did it before me. I mean, all those comic books, movies, TV shows. You'd think the one eccentric loner would have made himself a costume. I mean, is everyday life really so exciting? Are schools and offices so thrilling that I'm the only one who ever fantasized about this? Come on, be honest with yourself. At some point in our lives, we all wanted to be a superhero. Comic books had it wrong. You don't need a power to be a superhero. Oh, yeah. Didn't see that, did you?
PRI, Public Radio International.